Accession number 32064.
Alexander Campbell, Reel 1.
Alexander McCrory Campbell.
That's my mother's name. So tell me, when and where were you born?
I was born in Edinburgh on the 10th of March 1923.
And how long did you stay in Edinburgh for?
Until 1957. From 23 to 57. That's, what? 34 years.
34 years, yeah.
That's right.
So tell me, what do you remember about Edinburgh when you were growing up?
Odd things that stick in my mind. I always remember we lived in Edinburgh, and before I was born, before I was married, we lived not so far from Edinburgh Zoo. And I never took my children to the Edinburgh Zoo until we moved through to Glasgow. That's one that sticks in my mind.
And whereabouts in Edinburgh were you living as a child?
Where I was living?
Whereabouts in Edinburgh were you
living? Where I lived. Merkerson area, that's where it was. I lived in the Merkerson area. And then we moved out to the Murrayfield area. And that was quite good. Then, of course, I went to the services and came back and... Mm. Well, we aren't even too far ahead, haven't we?
Tell me, so when you were a boy, what did your father do?
My father was a grocer.
And did your mother work?
No. The woman's work in these days was in the home, mm-hmm. looking after children. I had a brother and a sister, and I was the youngest.
And what was school like?
I enjoyed school, actually. I remember being promoted to be a cloakroom boy at an early stage in life, and my very good friend and I were cloakroom boys. You felt very superior. You didn't have to line up to get in. You just went into your little job and looked after the cloakroom. And likewise, one of the pets that came along with it, we had a master who organised the football for the various schools. So very often on a Friday afternoon, you give an opportunity to go and deliver lists games to various schools, so that took you away from classes, which was quite good. And on balance, one's education didn't seem to suffer, and that was fine.
Mm-hmm. And how about hobbies? What did you do to have fun?
Oh, playing football in the street, I think, is about then. And then, as I got older, playing tennis mostly. That was the thing. But I was never a do-it-yourself sort of hobby man. Yeah.
And what made you think about joining the service?
I was conscripted. I had no choice.
That would focus things.
Strangely enough, that friend of mine who was a cloakroom boy with me, we both decided together we wanted to go to the Navy. But neither of us had any naval connections, but it's one of these things, boys, you have a dream you want to go to the Navy. He wanted to be sure he got a commission. So he went into the Fleet Air Arm so they could get a commission. That was fine. I was quite ambivalent on the basis that I wasn't so pleased to get in because so many people have been drafted into the Army. And that was it. Although I had it in my mind, if I was going to be in the Army, I'd go into the Guards and be a proper soldier. But thankfully, I was never put to the test.
What do you have any idea now what it was about the Navy that attracted you?
I have no idea. Just one of these things that you can see the connection, you've got some background, but nothing whatsoever, just one of the things.
And when were you conscripted?
On the 28th of May 1942.
So perhaps before we talk about that, what do you, just to sort of talk about the beginning of the war, to take you back a bit, did you have... Can you talk about that, the summer before the war? Did you have much sense of what was coming?
Well, going back to the day that war was declared, I remember as a family we were at church and the minister had arranged for a lady to take down Chamberlain's speech and read it out to us that the country was now at war. Came out of the church and standing, chatting, people do. Then the air raid sirens went. And we really thought, this is it, you know. First, the war's only just started. It turned out to be a false alarm, but that was sticking in my mind. And when we were well, between after the war, maybe 1940, I don't know, we were on holiday in Dunoon, and we took the opportunity to go through to Clyde Bank, which had been bombed, and to view the extent of the damage, and that focused your mind that war was not a very pleasant thing to do. Mm. There was an odd air raid at Queen's Ferry, which was nearby, where it was reputed that whiskey was running down the streets on fire. Whether that was true or not, I don't know. But there were.
And what else can you remember about how the outbreak of war changed your daily life?
Well, the first thing that happened, it ruined my schooling on the basis the schools went on to part-time education. And whilst I had boyhood ambitions to be a doctor, I never ever finished taking my hires because they weren't done at that time. And so the war in that respect changed my whole life. During the war, I became an ARP messenger, and I was based in a police station. And that coloured my mind that I'd like to be a policeman. So that was the intention to go along. That was thwarted in due course, and as much my brother joined the police force, and two in one family was not a good idea, so put that aside.
And how about, so you, what were you doing with your time? You could, school had cut down, so...
Well, that's a good question. I seem to recollect that my next door neighbour, he had a brother who had a radio supplies business. And I got a job there to help loading and unloading bits and pieces there. How long and how often, I don't really know. But I remember doing that and quite enjoying that. And that was obviously a means of earning some money, which was helpful.
And do you remember building a shelter or anything?
Yeah, like we put an Anderson shelter in the garden. And we were going down there as and when we acquired it. It doesn't stick in my mind as being a big part of my life, so I can't think that we went there too often. Obviously, we're privileged not to have too many air raids up in Edinburgh. That was it.
Yeah, so how often, how many air raids were there, do you think, or how regularly did it happen?
I have no idea. It didn't count these things. But I can only relate it to that. I don't think of myself being near this shelter a lot, but I can't think there were terribly many.
Yeah.
I mean, one got used to the blackout, and... incredibly, the blackout was a safer place than it is today, because people had a common purpose, looking after each other and a common enemy, so you could walk around in the blackout and be perfectly safe. Ladies could go there with no difficulty. It was a fine.
Okay. So tell me about, how did you hear about that you'd been conscripted?
I got the usual letter, but I was busy doing my insurance exams at that time, and I asked for a postponement so that I could finish my exams, and they gave me a postponement. Otherwise, I'd probably been away 3 months earlier, but mm-hmm. I don't know how long, but about that time.
So, 28th of May, 42, you said that was when you started?
That's when I...
Okay, and so tell me about sort of the process of getting there.
Well, I remember my father took me down to Waverley Station, and I met another... a lad there from Fife by the name of Brown, whom my mum was certain in my mind, they always meant to confirm it, that his elder brother was a goalkeeper of Heart of Midlothian Football Club, which I used to go and see. So we went in the train down to Tower Point in Cornwall, which is a long journey in these days, and that set us in for 12 weeks there, which I thoroughly enjoyed actually. So it was wonderful weather like this. And
did you say Long Point?
Did I?
Did you say Long Point in Cornwall?
Tor Point. T-O-R, Tor Point, just across from Plymouth.
Can you just...
HMS Rally.
Just describe it for me. Whatever you can remember of the base.
I can remember, but Chief Petty Officer Ward was our man in charge. He was called Sharkey, which apparently is a traditional name for a ward in the Navy. And he was a very good man indeed. He was... kept us moving about, but exercised good discipline. I remember the weather being such that we were allowed to take our tunics off, and those who suffered it could put a handkerchief round their neck to save them being struck by the sun. And altogether, to my mind, it was a very pleasing time. I had never done marching and drilling, etc. I'd been in the Boy Scouts, but we didn't do much, not the Boys Brigade, we didn't do exercising of that nature. So I quite enjoyed that. And you got one night off during the week, or maybe I think two nights off during the week till 7 o'clock, and one till 11 o'clock, which is very, very good indeed.
What did you get up to on your nights off?
I would go walking along from 12 Point to Lou and Polpero, and have a glass or two of cider and a Cornish pasty. And when you've got these things, you have to hand in your hat as security for your ticket. And it was quite good. And I remember certainly on one weekend we're down there, when weather like now, we discarded our tunics. And a naval officer came up to us, ever so polite, and said, "I know it's very hot weather, and I know the army are permitted to take the tunics off, but we're not allowed to do that in the Navy. So would you be kind enough to get the tunics on?" And because he asked us so politely, we went back to where we were staying the night, put our tunic on, and that was it. But it's the odd little things that stick in your mind, and that was it. It was just, if he'd been cross with us, we'd have probably ignored him, but working on the bases, we wouldn't see him again.
But because he'd been reading.
Because you're so polite, and you felt honoured, blind to oblige him.
And tell me about what you learned while you were there.
Well, I learned how to tie a few more knots and how to heave a line as opposed to heave a lead rather as opposed to swing the lead, you know.
What's the difference?
Well, so swing the lead is dodging, where heaving is the lead which you put into the water to measure the depth, etc. And that was it. And while I was there, I don't know what stage, but they decided I was potential officer material, so I was singled out on the basis that when I was posted to a ship as what they called a CW candidate, a Commissioned Warrant candidate. So you wore a white headband around your hat. And so when you went to a ship, all the dirty jobs were the five CWs plus. And as long as you didn't complain, that was fine. One of my colleagues complained, and it didn't make his life any easier, I can assure you. But whether it's painting the paint locker, the cable locker, or whatever, a coaling ship, as we have to do, it was quite different.
So just to take you back again to the tour point, so I'm just trying to get make sure I've got a sense of what you're learning. So you learned a few knots, you learned marching and drilling.
Well, a bit of seamanship told us what was required, and the difference between right and left, and a ship is sour and port, and such thing.
And was anything did you find anything difficult?
No, I thoroughly enjoyed it all. It was just like an advanced form of scout camp, extended.
And how did you find the living conditions?
I had no complaints at all with them.
And where were you were you staying sort of in a main building or in huts, or where were you sleeping?
Good question. I couldn't be specific on that, but my basic thought would be it was a hut. But I had no complaint about it, so whatever it was perfectly comfortable.
Yeah. And the discipline was the, because obviously it's sort of the life is much more regimented. How did you find that?
Well, I took the discipline quite well. I worked on the basis that if you're there, you might as well do as you're told and get on and enjoy it, as opposed to being a rebel. That was fine.
Yeah. And so what happened next? What came next?
Well, when we left Todd Point, we were posted to a ship called HMS Venomous, which was based at Londonderry. And I always remember going to Londonderry. We took the train up to Stranraer, and there was I in a brand new sailor suit, having to go on the ferry the next day over. And I visualised it myself. It was 6 miles. I feel, won't it be embarrassing when I'm seasick on the ferry? because we were pushing, had a breakfast on board the ferry before we went over. Suffice to say, no seasickness arose, but it was stuck in my mind. I was fearful of them. So we went up to London, then joined a ship, which was a great change altogether.
And this would be, so you said you're at Torpoint, I think, for 10 weeks, 11 weeks?
I think 12 weeks was the time I think we had.
So it would be about mid-August?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, so mid-August 42.
Because I remember that the first major exercise we had was going to be part of the escort of a Russian convoy. At that time, the largest convoy with about 80 ships protecting it. We stopped at Iceland on the way up, went ashore, played a bit of football, came back in, and probably about one day out from there, we developed condensitis. So we turned round and headed back to Belfast, and we were docked in Belfast for about 3 weeks having this done.
What's condensitis?
A condenser on the ship. In fact, the V&W were First World War destroyers, and so they were quite old. So the fact of breakdown was not unusual. Because it was a First World War destroyer, you were given an extra shilling a day, what they called hard lying money. Because if the weather was rough from the stern, the water would come right into the mess deck, and you would step out into water in your feet. Of course, in these days, as a young man, I didn't have the privilege of having a hammock netting. I mean, sailors get issued with hammocks, but you've got to have hooks to hang it to, and you had to earn that. So you spent your time lying on top of the lockers, sleeping. That was it. Eventually, from my time, I did get a hammock net, but that was situated above the hammock netting, which meant when everyone was getting up, putting the hammocks, throwing it away, boom, 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 you wouldn't get a long line in the morning. Anyway.
So tell me, just let me take you back, so that when you first joined the Venomous, can you remember the first time you saw her?
So?
Can you remember the first time you saw the Venomous?
No, I've no actual recollection. It's just a ship. I suppose it must have been awe-inspiring to suddenly realise that I was going to be living in this ship and get used to it.
And can you just give me give me a little thumbnail sketch of the ship? If I'm looking at the Venomous now, what am I looking at?
You're looking at a First World War destroyer. So it was a reasonably the bow was tapered and guns on both levels, and depth charges at the stern of the ship, and one of my duties was gun crew at one state, another part was depth charges at the other end. So depending what stage of alertness you were, whether you were on depth charges or whether you were on the guns. That was a really realising, you realise you're at war then when you go into involving the guns, and we had to fire the guns occasionally.
And so just tell me, describe sort of the staff on the ship. So what levels of crew have we got, and how many doing?
There'll be about
things.
140 of us in the ship, roughly. And we had a commander who was in charge of the ship at that time.
And can you remember?
I go later on, I mean, when we're in Gibraltar, I'm taking too far. I'll stop there, sorry.
Okay. So can you remember the name of the commander at the beginning? Can you remember the name of the commander at the beginning?
I think it was Maitland McGill Crichton, I think. Or maybe not. Maybe no. Maitland McGill Crichton was the captain who succeeded him. I can't remember him. He was posted to the Western Approaches as a be involved in organising Atlantic convoys. He was a stern, not a very good communicator, as far as we could see. The wardroom, the officers didn't seem to have the same knowledge, etc. I'll enlarge upon that a bit later.
And how did you find your place on the ship? You had this white band around your hat that presumably singled you out a little.
Well, as I say, when the bosun's meet was allocating the day's work, and as I say, it was calling ship, but if it was painting the cable, we would get picked for these jobs and anything else, or hosing down, swimming down. You know, but to my way of thinking, there are all jobs to be done, so what? Get on with it. No problem.
So tell me about a typical day on the Venomous. Tell me about a typical day on the Venomous. When, what time would it start?
Well, it depends which watch you're on. That's the point. I mean, with 24-hour watches that you varied from sort of... I mean, the middle watch was always the longest and the loneliest during the night. But you were just good, mostly waiting. I can always remember when we got our turn of being lookout in the crow's nest. In my own mind, I was one of the best lookouts because I was so petrified of heights that when I got up there, I would never dream of doing what others were calling to look down and wave to friends on the deck, etc. I stared ahead, etc. because it was sheer preservation. Not because I wanted to be a particularly good lookout, but I just couldn't dare to look down. Then when someone calls my turn, oh, they and down the ladder to get to them.
How long might you stay as a lookout for?
Well, you're probably only there maybe, say, half an hour. It wasn't a long time. They keep your eyes fresh and during your watch or you take them.
And so tell me about...
Yes, fair enough.
Okay. So tell me about the watches.
Well, you would start off on the morning watch, which would be from 8 to 12. Then the afternoon watch was from 12 to 4. And then after that, you had two short watches of 2 hours called the dog watches, 4 to 6 and 6 to 8. And then at 8 o'clock, you'd go on to the evening watch. Then at midnight, we'd go on to the middle watch until 4 o'clock in the morning. And you start again with your morning watch, and so it went on.
And how did you find that adjustment to your sleep patterns? I've often wondered how people adjust to this sort of much more broken sleep.
I think I have no actual recollection of it being a great problem. I think basically when you're young and you're happy to sleep, you'll sleep anywhere, any time. You've got the opportunity, you get on with it. It was fine.
And tell me about some of the jobs. You said the bosun had you doing.
Well, I mean, you're scrubbing down the deck. That was a regular job with the hose and the brush and scrub it down. Chipping rust off the ship paint and red-leading it and repainting it. And from time to time, you had to go over the side and paint the outside of the ship just the same. But that was done in harbour. That wasn't done at sea. But at sea, you'd be chipping on the lead as it goes.
And I assume at this point you also encountered the rum ration.
Yes, I wasn't old enough to draw a rum ration, you see. So, strange enough, it's one of the things I would abhor is rum. The smell of it was enough to put me off. So I was never tempted, etc., on the rum ration. I'll enlarge upon that later in my life.
And how did you get on with everybody else on board? Were there any particular characters?
Oh, some of the very particular characters. The three bad seamen who've been there all their life. And I can think particularly in the mess deck I had, we had two. One was quite a big fellow, and the other was a stocky Welshman, Taffy, and they were at loggerheads with each other. So every now and again, there'd be a bit of a fisticuff breakout there. They just couldn't stand each other. Although that same old badge, I remember him showing me how to iron the collar that you wore on your neck with a piece of wood shaped like a cricket bat. And you rolled it up and you banged it and rolled it out, banged it and rolled it. There weren't any irons available, and that was how it got flat.
So you banged it flat?
You rolled it up and you banged it and rubbed it out. Rolled it out.
Got you. And so tell me, once you joined, tell me about anything you remember, sort of any of the memorable...
Well, I remember the food was essentially the same every day. Roast beef and roast potatoes and what are called Buster's peas. And in the ship it was canteen messing, which meant that each section of the ship were responsible for preparing their own food. The cook only had his responsibility of looking after your dishes in the kitchen. He didn't cook anything. And if you wanted, it was normally a one-course dinner, but if you had an enterprising people, you could have a pudding or a sweet. And we had one chap who was a wire worker in Sheffield, and he was very good. So when he was cooking the mess, you always had a sweet. It was very good. Because you took your turn too, if you had to be cooking the mess, and you took over after a meal, did the washing up and move right through to the next meal.
And did you ever make a sweet or come up with anything unusual?
I don't remember ever being ambitious enough to do it like that. I think I just survived, etc. And then every now and again, of course, someone would empty the Dixie with cutlery and go over the side. So then you find yourself, if you could get a fork, you were lucky.
So what happened?
Well, I mean, you did the washing up in a metal can of water, and then of course they hadn't emptied it all out, and they threw it, they discovered. So you really had to use your knife, your sailor's knife, to cut things for you. And if you had one utensil, be it a spoon or a fork, a spoon would be ideal. You could cope with that one. And that was until you next went back to draw new supplies of cutlery, etc. One time. These things did happen.
And how did people relax? Was there cards or games on board?
I don't have any particular recollection of doing anything particular or seeing anything particular during relaxation time. One of the best times during the night was when you had cocoa brought round during the night. That always seemed to be rich and fat, and you could literally wipe the fat off your lips. It was, and when a cold night, it was very, very sustaining. Very good. One looked forward to that. And the Dixie or the pan that was left for was reserved for that. Nothing else was put in that pan except the cocoa, heated up so it came round and dished it here.
And was there was a particular way of making cocoa, wasn't there? Or with a block of cocoa?
It was a block. Passos Cai, as they called it.
And so tell me about, you came back with condenseritis. Was that after your first left port?
Come back.
You said you left port to begin with,
yes,
and then you came back.
No, that's how. Then we went to Belfast for that.
So. So tell me what happened next.
That was very good because one of the other CW candidate worked in the bank in Belfast, and he was a bit kind enough to take me out to his fiancée's house, and so you had the joy of having a bath, for example. That was wonderful. And go to the social club with the bankers and really live like a normal being. So,
how did you normally wash on board?
How
would you wash on board?
Oh, you had to pump the water up and put it into a tank, really all the terms, to heat it up. And then you got a bucket for yourself, and in that bucket you had to wash yourself and your clothes. That was your lot. And it was in an open space of probably must have been about a dozen, six or sailors, I think. And you had a sheet come down, but the cold winds, etc., came along. So modesty never arose there. You had to get on and get yourself washed and clean and get dressed.
And what was the trick to managing to wash yourself and all of your clothes in one bucket? Was there an order?
Well, yes. You sort of washed your clothes first, make sure you have enough water, then wash yourself, and that was it.